You've got to interlace your fingers and scrub your fingertips, you know, that touches, oh, everything from buttons to elevator buttons, everything else. Wash the back and the front of your hands. You're doing it for yourself. You're doing it for your family. You're doing it for the whole community to stop community spread. We have to keep each other safe in this very dire time of this pandemic. That does it for the show. I want to thank the amazing team that makes Democracy Now! Happen every day. So many of us working from home in isolation to protect everyone else, and the team that comes in to do this broadcast. And also a belated birthday. Happy wishes to Miriam Barnard. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Caron. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you so much.
Ya no pienso mantener este cariño. Ya no pienso mantener este cariño. Mientras me parto el alma, te das la vida de placeres, y yo el mis
KBOO, desvelos. Portland, Oregon, bridging the gap between prisons, prisoners, and the community. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, the latest news on the coronavirus and its impact from Dr. David Hammelstein, Distinguished Professor of Public Health at the City University of New York. Also, as the pandemic continues its march across the globe, starting today, South Africa will begin a 21-day lockdown. We speak with Mazi Bukojara, Deputy Director of the Shisemani Center for Activist Education in Cape Town, South Africa. And for our weekly Earth Watch, the consequences of interactions among species, particularly as biodiversity declines. Some warn that the coronavirus is a warning shot from nature. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Before we go to our first segment today, just wanted to share some good news. We could use some of that in this terrible time. And this is regarding the Dakota Access Pipeline. The court has struck down permits, which is a victory for the Standing Rock Sioux. We are going to post some more information about it, but a victory thus far for the Standing Rock Sioux. And the Guardian is reporting that the future of the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline has been thrown into question. It was a federal court on Wednesday that struck down its permits and offered a comprehensive environmental review. Of course, many are expecting that the environmental review will take some time. Also, just wanted to share some news for you on the Haiti front in relation to the coronavirus. And Cuba has just sent 348 doctors and nurses to be on the ground in Haiti to assist with the pandemic. So wanted to share that news with you as well. But now we are going to turn our attention to this update on what is happening with the coronavirus. On March 11, 2020, the World Health Organization declared the coronavirus a pandemic. Today, 2 weeks later, things have only continued to get worse. As of Thursday, March 26, there have been 21,571 reported deaths and 480,446 confirmed cases of COVID-19 around the world. Thus far, Italy has been the hardest hit, reporting 7,503 deaths. In the United States, as of the time we go on air, there have been 1,046 deaths that have been reported and 69,197 confirmed cases. New York City has become the epicenter of the coronavirus in the U.S., where 366 people have died and over 33,000 people have been tested positive. At least 13 patients have died from the coronavirus at Elmhurst Hospital in New York, all taking place within the last 24 hours. Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate has passed a $2 trillion rescue package to address the coronavirus's pandemic economic impact, as millions across the country remain desperate for relief. It is the largest economic rescue package in the history of the United States. The legislation, which passed 96-0 in the Senate, would send checks to more than 150 million households across the U.S. and set up huge loan programs for businesses large and small. Also, it would inject billions of dollars into unemployment insurance programs and increase spending on hospitals, among other measures. By the way, the breaking news is, as of 8 minutes ago, CNBC is reporting that the jobless claims in the United States have gone past 3 million to a record high. There are some, though, who are shortchanged in the rescue package, including undocumented immigrants, unwage caregivers, domestic workers, sex workers, and many who work in the informal economy and who have not been able to file taxes. Women who are stuck in domestic violence situations at home now with the stay-at-home orders, without money of their own, they are also being put at greater risk and have been shortchanged in this legislation. Big businesses will receive a massive bailout from the government, and while the legislation is temporarily keeping the economy afloat, many economists say that in the long run, this won't be enough. Now, on Wednesday, though, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said that Democrats were going to press for another wave of direct payments to people as Congress begins weighing the next round of emergency relief. All are predicting that the bill that passed the Senate will be taken up and passed by the House tomorrow. But what Nancy Pelosi is indicating is that there are other relief legislation to come. Nancy Pelosi pointed out that the cash payments to citizens are just not enough, calling for another round of checks and the next wave of stimulus. Now, that would be, if that happens, the fourth stimulus since the crisis began, and it is to be considered in the weeks ahead. Meanwhile, doctors and nurses are reporting gear shortages, lax protocols, and a high level of stress and danger in their workplaces, with the worst still to come. Also today, mothers and other caregivers are calling for a virtual social media march on the Capitol, demanding that rescue legislation should include fully refundable child tax credits, including for the most impoverished mothers and other primary caregivers, as well as for a care income for those who care for children, the elderly, people with disabilities, and the environment. Before we welcome our guests, let us now go to a clip from CNN about, in all of this, Donald Trump is talking about wanting to reopen the economy. What is that going to mean in terms of the death rate or the numbers of people who then will be exposed to the pandemic? Let's go to that clip now.
The president isn't backing off his prediction that the country could reopen by Easter, though public health experts and economists are warning it's unlikely and inadvisable.
Who suggested Easter?
I just thought it was a beautiful time.
The country still doesn't have widespread testing for the coronavirus, and confirmed cases are increasing by the hour. It's also not clear that Trump informed his task force beforehand about the date he had picked.
I don't know how well informed they were.
Deciding when people go back to work may not be up to the president. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy says he hopes that Trump is right, but his state will stay the course until he decides it's ready.
My fear, based on the meetings we're having constantly, would suggest that we're not going to be out of the woods by then. I hope I'm wrong. I hope they're wrong. My fear is they're not.
For now, the president is telling Americans to continue social distancing.
Keep following our guidelines on social distancing.
But sources tell CNN he's growing antsy at being sealed off from the outside world. Without lunches with foreign leaders or arenas filled with supporters, Trump has wondered aloud when life will return to normal for the nation and for himself. Outside of necessary governing, day-to-day operations at the White House have also been scaled back. Public tours have been canceled, the yearly Easter egg roll was called off, and the state dinner with the King and Queen of Spain has been postponed. The slowdown in the president's own life has led in part to his desire to lift guidelines that are keeping many at home. The president has been working the phones, speaking with New York Governor Andrew Cuomo several times a day. Yesterday, the White House advised that anyone who left New York City in recent days should self-quarantine for 2 weeks.
You may have been exposed before you left New York.
But New York State is shrugging off that suggestion.
I don't know medicine. I would turn to the doctor.
After Trump didn't say whether he gave Cuomo a heads up, the New York State Health Commissioner pushed back on the White House's advice.
I would not follow that. I believe that you should follow the guidelines in general, that you should social distance.
Now, Jake, the president's top economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, was just on television, and he's predicting a large increase in those unemployment numbers that we're going to see come out tomorrow morning. And that comes as the president himself is tweeting, saying that the media wants him to keep the country closed because they want it to be detrimental to his success in the November election.
That, of course, is nonsense. The media is listening to health officials who say if the country opens up before it's ready, it will cost hundreds, thousands, maybe even more lives. Caitlin Collins, thank you so much.
All righty, there you go. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. I would now like to welcome back to our show Dr. David Hammelstein, Distinguished Professor of Public Health at the City University of New York. He is a lecturer in medicine at Harvard Medical School and a primary care doctor in the Bronx in New York City. Dr. Hammelstein co-founded Physicians for a National Health Program, a group whose 23,000 members advocate for Medicare for All. Dr. David Hammelstein, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
First, your response to the discussion that is quite heated at the moment about the possibility of the country being reopened. I mean, so many of us are in under stay at home directives, and I wonder your thoughts on that. What do you think that would mean if, in fact, the president goes ahead with his idea of the country being reopened by Easter?
Yeah, it's likely to mean many unnecessary deaths. I mean, we're never sure where this epidemic is going. But our best estimate is that it's still going to be growing around Easter time. And saying that we're going to open things back up at that point is tantamount to saying, let's let the epidemic explode. So unless things turn around in a very unexpected way, saying that we're going to stop the social distancing measures and reopening the economy, put people who were not in essential jobs back in work, that's going to cause tremendous deaths and suffering.
Yeah, I mean, it's really shocking that it's so clear that the discussion is really about protecting human life versus what is needed in the market at the moment. I'm sure that many people are shocked that this kind of discussion is happening at all. But I also wanted you to respond to this. Just today, someone sent me a letter from Sarah Lozano, who is an emergency medicine physician at Brockton Hospital in Brockton, Massachusetts. And here's what the good doctor says. She says, "My hospital is extremely short on personal protective equipment. We have 1 week's supply of masks, and we are running low on gowns, eye protection goggles, face shields, gloves, and cleaning wipes. Without this protective gear, especially without properly fitting masks, healthcare workers are putting themselves at risk of becoming infected with the coronavirus. Some will develop serious illness and some could die. Furthermore, we risk the spread of the infection to our families and to patients and other staff at the hospital." And then she goes on to ask for donations of any of the above mentioned items. In particular, she pointed out masks. Your reaction to this, how often are you hearing this story? What are your concerns about this? And what will it mean not only for our medical people who are putting themselves, their lives, their families at risk, but many of whom are getting ill, but also for the patients that they're caring for? Dr. Himmelstein.
Well, we're hearing this from all of the places where the epidemic is exploding. So New York is the place where things are most extreme at this point. There are 18,000 cases in New York City alone, and 10,000 or so additional in the area immediately around New York City. And the hospitals there are being inundated, and they're either close to or in some cases are just about to run out of this protective equipment. We're hearing that people are being issued one mask for the week. These are masks that are not supposed to be reused at all. So normally they would be changed after each patient, but doctors and nurses and others who work in hospitals are being told, "Here's your mask for the week," and at the end of the workday, put them in a paper bag and come back and reuse them for the next day. Same thing with face shields. So it's clear that this is putting the healthcare workforce at risk. And our president is still not invoking the national act that would allow him to instruct private industry to make masks and the other essential things that are needed. So we're way behind and probably getting further behind. The estimate is we're going to need billions of masks to fulfill what's needed in the couple of months ahead. And we're nowhere close to having that available.
It's really shocking to experience, actually, because we're all living through this, what you are saying. And also, the governor of New York, who's been quite outspoken about a lot of this, he has said that of the stimulus package that was passed, the $2 trillion stimulus package, $100 billion of that to go to hospitals. However, he's saying that New York is getting is just a drop in the bucket, which is quite shocking considering New York is the epicenter. And on the National Defense Act, I mean, Donald Trump, it seems, on the one hand, he's invoking the act. He's mentioned it. This was a week ago or so, was it now? But as you say, it has not been implemented. And then you have states that are now competing with each other to try to get these kinds of supplies that are very much in shortage. And I wondered your thoughts on that as well, because the governors, I'm sure, are trying to get their hands on whatever they could get for their particular state. But that's not exactly how it should go, should it, Dr. Himmelstein?
Well, this is in a way a symptom of what's crazy about our whole healthcare system and whole healthcare policy, that for the last 30 years or so, we've pursued healthcare policies that say that each hospital ought to compete with every other and states ought to compete with each other. Instead, we need a cooperative model where we say, what are the overall needs? Let's put the resources where they're most needed. And our federal government isn't doing that. On an emergency basis, some states have finally begun to step in and say hospitals need to cooperate, not compete with one another. But after 30 years of saying this is a dog-eat-dog world, the transition to saying solidarity and cooperation is the way we need to go, that's a big lift. So, I mean, it just in New York State, we're estimating that we need 30,000 ventilators, and the federal government is saying there are 4,000 that are being made available. And what that's going to mean is that thousands of patients are likely to die because we don't have the breathing machines that could keep them alive until their body recovers from this illness. And with some planning and mobilization, we could clearly really fill that void in the places that are hot spots at the beginning and ship the resources to where they're needed. And frankly, with federal government action early on, we could have had ventilators already being manufactured. I noticed that in Britain they've come up with a simple sort of engineering how to make ventilators that are simple and quickly made, and they estimate that in 2 weeks they'll begin to turn out 5,000 of those a week, and we're being told that by May we'll be manufacturing large numbers of new ventilators in this country. So the both preparedness has been wanting, the federal government action once the epidemic was underway has been slow and cumbersome, and the coordination and cooperation has been just completely missing at the federal level and beginning in some of the states.
I personally could speak about the importance of ventilators. I mean, when I was in intensive care some years back with double pneumonia, without that kind of support, I wouldn't be interviewing you right now, Dr. Hammelstein. So, you know, it really is about life and death, and the idea that the lives of people who live in this country are being treated with such disregard is really shocking. I mean, I was so moved by the letter of this emergency medicine physician. By the way, the area of Massachusetts she's in apparently is a low-income community with a number of immigrants in them, particularly immigrants from Haiti. And that's another concern about places that serve, you know, kind of impoverished people. Where are they going to be on the totem pole? But what she also says, and I wondered your thoughts on this, she's asking for donations, but she says a mask or respirator used by painters and construction workers could also be extremely helpful, as we may be able to reuse these. If you know any construction workers, painters, or anyone who may own this or other masks, we would be extremely grateful for their donation. This is
hard. Well, she's exactly right that in fact the what's called N95 masks, which are the masks that most healthcare workers would want to wear in this situation, are routinely sold in hardware stores and places like Home Depot for construction workers and painters. So they're the same masks, and they ought to be mobilized for the medical personnel at this point. And you're right that Brockton, where she's writing from, is a low-income area. I lived for and worked for many years in Massachusetts and still spend part of my time up there at Harvard Medical School. And in general, around the country, low-income areas have been deprived of medical facilities. That's not where the money is in healthcare, so they've had relatively few doctors, and hospitals have largely avoided the areas where people of color and poor people live, because again, when you base a healthcare system on the market, what you're saying is profitability is what determines where hospitals want to locate and where they want to draw their patients from. And one of the things that's been really striking in this situation, in this epidemic, is that the hospitals are full, but they're losing money. And the reason they're losing money is that they're not doing the stuff that is their usual money maker, which is elective surgery and joint replacements and things that are in fact much less urgent than what they're doing now, but that are the bread and butter of how you make money in this healthcare system. And I think that highlights, in a way, what's wrong with our healthcare system. It's oriented towards how profitable you are as the measure of your success, rather than how successful you are in improving health or preventing deaths. And in this epidemic, hospitals are saying, well, we're having to turn to what's needed rather than what's profitable, and that's causing a tremendous financial shock.
Yeah, and I have to say, I mean, hats off, and we're so grateful to all of the doctors and nurses, the RNs, the LVNs, all of the support staff, the cleaning staff, the ambulance drivers, all of them that are still showing up for work and saving lives. And just finally, on your last point, it seems as though what this system has also done, but also the fact that the country is so unprepared for a pandemic such as this, increasingly forces doctors to make really difficult decisions about who's going to get treatment, who's not, who's going to get the ventilator, and who's not. And that may be a decision about who's going to live and who's going to die. And for people who are elders, for people who are 60 years or 65 years and older, you know, I've heard some people say that, God forbid, at my age, I end up in the hospital with this virus, because I might not make it because of the lack of supplies. I may be left to die so that the equipment could save the life of somebody who is younger and therefore have a lot more productive years, quote unquote productive years, left. And this is so heartbreaking. Dr. Hammerstein, just some final thoughts from you on this, and any other thoughts?
Yeah, those are the decisions that we're likely to be facing in the days ahead. We've not heard yet that that's had to be done in the U.S. It's certainly being done in Italy and almost certainly in Spain as well, and we see it coming down the pike at us in the U.S. And again, those decisions could have been avoided if we'd had a government that was actually functional. And you know, if there's a natural disaster that you can't do anything about, that's one thing. But this is not just a natural disaster that we couldn't have done anything about. It's a natural disaster whose consequences were anticipated by the infectious disease community for years, and the administration dismantled much of our preparedness capability. And frankly, previous administrations were none too good about that either. We lost 50,000 state and local public health workers since 2008 because of a lack of funding. And those are the folks who were probably in the best position if we'd had reasonable numbers of tests and other mobilization early on to stop this epidemic early. But because of those failures, we're facing not just heart-rendering, but horrendous decisions that doctors and nurses are going to have to be making. And I might add that we're used to thinking of doctors and nurses at risk. Cleaning personnel may be at least as much risk as the doctors and nurses. They're going in to the rooms that are contaminated and doing the cleaning up. So it's the broad hospital workforce that are really at risk, and we should remember that.
Yeah, and they're very much the people who are forgotten. We also, earlier this week, spoke to a UPS warehouse worker, and we're so dependent on them as well, making deliveries to people's homes, talking about the lack of care in their workplaces in terms of cleaning and hand sanitizers and more. So it's very much, you're absolutely right, those workers that are at the bottom and doing those kinds of jobs that are very, very much at risk. Dr. Himmelstein, we really appreciate you taking the time to be with us, because it's so important that we all listen to science and the scientists and to the medical people right now, as opposed to, you know, the kind of sideshow, these are using my words, election type rallies that are happening with these briefings headed by Donald Trump. But we appreciate you and all of the work that you're doing, and we hope that you're well. By the way, are you and your family, are you all safe and well?
We are safe and well, and I'm actually, because I'm over 60 myself, the hospitals are saying that only in case of extreme emergency would people my age be asked to care for COVID patients. I should say my daughter is a resident at a hospital in Boston, so she's at this point more on the front lines than I am, but she's well.
Yeah, but you know what? I think given what's coming down the pike, you're going to be needed. And I wouldn't be surprised that you will be getting that call to come in very, very soon. Well, please keep us posted. We'll have you back to the degree that you have the time to share with us. Thank you so very much, and all the best to you and your daughter and all those now working to keep us all alive and well. Thank you, Dr. David Himmelstein. Okay, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take our station break. And you know what? We see the difficulties. Those of us who are living in allegedly the wealthiest nation on the planet and can't get a mask, can't get a test for the coronavirus. Imagine what will happen in countries of the global south, the continent of Africa. We're going to be focusing on Africa, specifically South Africa, next. Stay with us. You don't want to go anywhere. You won't want to miss that. We'll be right back. And that is the late, great Aretha Franklin, Bridge Over Troubled Water. That's basically what we're trying to do right now. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Check us out on Facebook. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. Our handle on Twitter and Instagram at So True Radio. We're also nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. Today, we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Elmhurst, New York. Elmhurst, New York. Internationally, we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in South Africa. And also, just a special note to all of you, the Sojourner Truth listeners, we really hope that you and your loved ones are safe and well, that you are taking the precautions. Please listen to what the doctors are saying, washing hands frequently. And this is a time for us to take care of each other, to look out for the elders in our neighborhoods and see that they are well. We are indeed our sister and brother's keeper, especially at this time. If you want to email us or go on Facebook and just send any messages or let us know how you are, any challenges that you're facing, we really want to know. We care about you. You are our priority. And now we are going to continue our coverage of the coronavirus as it continues its march across the planet. Before we welcome our guests from South Africa and to give some information about what is happening there, I just want to go to a clip from CNN about the low supply chain and the connection between that and the segment that's coming up. This is a low supply chain in the United States, the richest country on the planet. Imagine what countries in Africa are going to be facing. Let's go to that clip now.
Do you in the hospital halls see light at the end of the tunnel, as the president seems to?
You know, quite honestly, look, I'm not here to talk politics. I'm here to talk about patients. And the reality is that what we're seeing right now in our emergency rooms is dire. Last week when I went to work, we talked about the one or two patients amongst the dozens of others that might have been a COVID, a coronavirus patient. This week in my shift yesterday, nearly every single patient that I took care of was coronavirus, and many of them extremely severe. Many were put on breathing tubes, many decompensated quite quickly. There is a very different air this week than there was last week. And quite honestly, you know, think about the fact that our first New York City case was on March 1st. That's just over 3 weeks ago. To think that we'll be in any place to lift these restrictionary measures by Easter and just, you know, in 2 or 3 weeks, for me, seems completely magical thinking. What we know is that there's math and modeling that can tell us that the number of cases is going to continue to rise. We're really at the beginning of this outbreak, and you can feel that. You can sense that. It's palpable on the front lines in the emergency department.
And in terms of supplies, do you have all the supplies you need? Because I cannot tell you how many messages I'm getting from nurses and doctors and hospitals all over New York, you know, with very specific examples of what they do not have.
Yeah. You know, the supply chain is extremely tight. One thing I tell people is that when I worked in West Africa for Ebola, the one thing I never worried about was having enough PPE, the personal protective equipment. It's something that my colleagues all over New York City are worried about right now. The number of masks that people are given, you know, some people are given one N95 respirator mask that's the thicker one that helps prevent the virus from being inhaled by a provider. Given one of those a week, and the CDC doesn't want you using those. People are given one surgical mask a shift, and everyone is doing everything they can to conserve supplies because we know we're just at the beginning of this. And after New York will be New Jersey, will be New Mexico. This is going to be a marathon. We are not even at the beginning of this.
All righty. And, you know, the coronavirus pandemic now in over 100 countries, including 46 on the continent of Africa. There are now more than 2,400 confirmed cases of the coronavirus across Africa, 60 reported deaths so far, according to The Guardian. This, of course, is the time that we are on air. The World Health Organization has warned that these figures underestimate its real impact on the region, and little attention has been paid to how the pandemic will hit countries of the global south who, after decades of colonialism and imperialism, are lacking resources to the degree available in countries of the global north. And as you know, even in countries of the global north, the United States, Italy, Spain, there is a crisis of shortages, supplies, and equipment. So what's going to happen when this pandemic continues its march across the globe and hitting countries at even greater disadvantage? Now, in South Africa, which only emerged from apartheid in 1990 and had its first democratic election in 1994, now has 60 reported deaths, 709 confirmed cases. Close to a third of the confirmed coronavirus cases on the continent of Africa have been reported in South Africa. And starting today, March 26th, the government has begun a 21-day lockdown to be, they say, enforced by the police and army. Keep in mind that South Africa is the most economically unequal country in the world. On that note, I'd like to welcome our guest, Mazibuko Jara, the Deputy Director of the Shisimani Center for Activist Education in Cape Town, South Africa. Mazibuko Jara, thank you for joining us.
Greetings. Thank you for having us, and greetings to your listeners.
Okay. Now, just your assessment of the situation. You heard the clip. I'm sure you've been following some of the difficulties even in the United States. What about a country like South Africa, where there's chronic underlying conditions are common, high levels of HIV, both treated and untreated, a lot of poverty? What are some of the challenges that will have to be faced in South Africa?
We are reaching the end of the first phase of the pandemic in South Africa. That first phase is basically people who were exposed to the virus through international travel. Now we're going to get a ballooning of the numbers through in-country infections. That's where the big problem lies. As you've pointed out, to the dire social and economic circumstances. In addition to that, we have a very poor public health system. So, for example, the testing system to test for the virus or even other conditions that is supposed to be run by the national government is in a very weak state. So that means that large numbers of people will not even get to know until they feel the symptoms that actually they are infected. That's the first problem. Secondly, many people, because we've got low employment levels, normally eke out a living through hustling, through the informal economy, through holding several part-time jobs, and other activities in the informal economy, are not going to be able now to do that hustle because of the lockdown. And yet, government has not announced a food distribution program or has not provided strong enough measures to provide some measure of income protection for those at work. So we're going to see many people being actually locked away to suffer in their homes, in informal shanty towns, in the townships, without access to a public health system or without access to the most basic necessity, food.
Yeah, and it's just heartbreaking hearing what you are describing. And I understand that there's a call for social solidarity in South Africa and a series of demands. What can you tell us about those?
We're calling on the South African government to provide support to workers, to people in the informal economy, to townships, to shanty towns, to villages and inner cities. Food, distribution of water, distribution of masks, but also distribution of sanitizers, because those are just not in the package government is putting forward in an effective way. But also, government is failing to use its power to ensure that privatized healthcare actually is brought to the board, on board to respond to the pandemic. For example, the national public health system only has about 6,000 beds for intensive care, and yet the privatized healthcare system has got in excess of 40,000 beds. And yet government has not even announced simple basic measures it would take to ensure access to those beds. That just shows how government is just not committed to the people, but is actually committed to securing, even at this hour of need, the profits of a few. Similarly, government has not even taken strong measures to ensure a stimulus package that can ensure that the economy is not collapsing. So we are calling on government to really review what its intervention is about, to ensure that it really addresses the needs of the majority. But also, what we are calling on government to do is to ensure that the lockdown is about a public health intervention. We are very worried that government insists on a security, militarized, repressive approach to the lockdown because it realizes that its socioeconomic measures are not adequate. So we're calling on government to reorient its approach away from that militarized logic and now look at ways that can ensure effective access to public health. Of course, we know that government is not going to be able to deliver this on its own, which is why then we're also on the ground trying to mobilize communities, public education, mutual aid, raising resources, and also trying to generate donations of food to reach the most poorest of our communities. That's not going to be easy because under conditions of lockdown, there's a limited movement, but we're trying all we can to move in that direction.
Right. And what, just in terms of what some of our listeners can do, is there a website or a way that people could find out about what you and your organization are doing on the ground and perhaps offer some support?
We have set up a website which will start operating on Saturday. The website is C19 People's Coalition. .org.za C19 People's Coalition. .org.za. It will start operating on Saturday, and through that, we will be keeping the community updated, but also ways in which people can provide donations or even spread messages of solidarity and also direct pressure to the South African government.
Right. Well, Masibuko, we're going to have to leave it there, but here's what we'll do. We will promote that website. It's starting Saturday on our social media, and we're also going to check back with you so that you could give our listeners an update on how things are going with our sisters and brothers on the ground in South Africa. Thank you so very much for joining us, and thank you for your work.
Thank you.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're now going to go to our weekly Earth Watch and welcome Dr. Felicia Kiesing, Distinguished Professor of the Sciences at Bard College in New York. She studies the consequences of interactions among species, particularly as biodiversity declines. Dr. Felicia Kiesing, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, though I'm sorry about the circumstances.
Yeah, and, you know, I saw a shocking headline in The Guardian just a few days ago that says, nature is sending us a message, and that was an announcement made by the UN Environment Chief, Inger Andersen. And I wonder if you agree with that, and just in terms of the work that you are doing in Kenya and other places, tell us your concerns of what's happening now.
Well, I think we've known for years in the scientific community that the destruction of biodiversity is making it more likely that emerging infectious diseases will jump to us. So those are warnings that scientists have been giving for years. And we also know that the destruction of biodiversity is causing increases in diseases that we already knew about. So we all, you know, in the scientific community, we had a lot of evidence that this was likely to happen. I think what we're experiencing now was in many ways the worst case scenario, and everyone hoped that we would figure this out before it came to such a horrible virus. But there were certainly warnings that something like just what's unfolded could happen.
We know that right now everybody is very, very focused, of course, in what could be done to stop the pandemic. But also a lot have been made about what's called these wet markets. Certainly that was the case in China and in other parts of Africa as well. And apparently, well, maybe you could tell us, you know, what these live animal markets are for people who may not know.
Yeah, sure. So these live animal markets are places where wildlife from a vast region are brought into a centralized place to be sold, typically as food. And so the species that are in those markets, in many cases, don't naturally occur together in their natural habitats. So these are places where you're creating high densities of wildlife from diverse habitats. You're putting them together under really stressful conditions, and then you're bringing in high densities of people. And so these are exactly the kinds of conditions that scientists have been warning are likely to lead to a pathogen, a disease-causing agent, jumping from one of these wildlife species into something else that it would never otherwise naturally encounter. So it's easy, especially in this moment of fear for us all, to blame the wildlife, but it's hardly their fault. They don't want to be there, you know.
Really?
they are being brought there by people, so it's people's behaviors. It's also easy, though, to pin the blame on these wildlife markets and these wet markets, and I think we need to acknowledge that there are things that people do all around the world that increase the probability of these kinds of things happening. So, for example, another risky situation is where you have super high densities of domesticated animals like pigs or cows, and those are right up next to wildlife, you know, wild areas, because you can also get this kind of transfer from wildlife into domesticated stock and domesticated animals. And so we create those conditions all the time through our eating habits, right, indirectly. And so I think it's important not to put the blame solely on these wet markets. That appears to be how it happened this time, and we've certainly known that those were risk zones, but we also have to look at our own behavior and how that contributes to it.
I'm so glad you made that point, because I can't help but note or feel that there's a kind of a racist undertone to this whole thing about these markets. I mean, whether or not here you have Trump talking about the quote-unquote Chinese virus, which is absolutely outrageous and absurd and racist, right? But people, you know, this view of like, well, you have these people who are somewhat quote-unquote primitive, and they have these wet markets, and this is totally uncivilized, and this is what's causing the problem. But as you point out, that is not the case, really. And, all of these, I'm glad you talked about the pigs and the cows and the rest of that in terms of these mega farming, because we see also increasingly on the continent of Africa huge land grabs of to do all kinds of damage to nature. But also there, from what I've read, that the virus also poses a threat to the great apes is what I'm hearing.
So this virus is what's called a zoonotic virus, meaning that it can move between humans and other animals. And our focus right now has been on how it came from wildlife into people. So that's one direction of movement. But a zoonotic pathogen like this can also go from humans into other animals. So there was a big round of alarm about this a couple of weeks ago now, when people thought that their pets might be susceptible and those pets would have gotten it from us. So what other wildlife could also get it from us? Well, one likely possibility is that our closest relatives could get it from us, and that's where the concern about the great apes comes in. So we are now amplifying this virus all around the world, and that means that we can spill it back into wildlife that weren't infected with it naturally. So that can certainly happen. And as far as the question about the underlying racism of all of this, I think we all need to be really, really careful about that. It's we're hearing, as you say, from the president and from others, ways in which it's being there's blaming, right? And there's sort of a blaming on the one side, pointing it to it's being a Chinese virus, and then there's we're seeing acts of retribution all around the United States and I suspect around the world as well, although I'm not as familiar with those. If there's any better signal of the fact that we're all in this together, I don't know what it is other than this virus. The fact that we are all so similar and that the virus can get to us all around the world suggests a real need for global cooperation and global caretaking more than it does blaming and othering people.
That's right. And the interrelationship between those of us who are two-legged, as indigenous people say, and the whole of the rest of nature, and respecting and taking care of nature. Dr. Felicia Kiesing, we really appreciate you joining us, your expertise. We're posting information about your work, and we want to also thank the Global Justice Ecology Project. We partner with them for our weekly Earth Watch. There are actually some other things I would love to speak with you about sometime, about the work that you've been doing in Kenya, in particular, and with savanna communities and the disappearance of large animals, etc. So perhaps you'll join us again.
I look forward to it. Thank you so very much.
Okay, this is Margaret Prescott. We are out of time. I'd like to thank all of today's guests. I'd like to thank our engineer for today, Kiana Williams, our assistant producer, Romero Funes, and all who helped with today's show. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for joining us, and please stay safe. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Thank you. Cesar Chavez. You're listening to KBOO, listener-sponsored radio.
Good morning. You are tuned into KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial. My name is Tammy, and you are listening to Popular Education Radio. On this episode of Popular Education Radio, I'll be interviewing Professor